Okay, so I'm recording. It has a nice automatic gain control, so it picks up my voice really nicely. If you have a question in the room, sometimes it doesn't pick up the question. And that's good because some students don't want to have any information on the internet that relates to them, like their voice, for instance. Okay, so if you're concerned about your anonymity and you don't want me to put these lectures online, let me know and I won't upload them. Right, and you can feel free to ask me any question that you want. Right, you have to let me know the first week. And you don't have to do it right now. You can do it in private or send me an email or whatever. Okay, but usually your voice doesn't come across well enough to figure out who you are on the internet. All right, so I have to say for the recording, it is January 28th, and this is Bio 241, introductory lecture. Okay. All right, so you can find that there. And you can see that there are some videos right here, other kinds of information that you might want to look at during the semester or have with you, like a periodic table. Here's another piece of paper that outlines some of the anatomy of the ear for you, because we're going to look at functions of the ear sooner or later. And course information, I want to download Spring. Okay, I already sent you weekly study plan. You should work with that. Maybe you want to show me. This is just a technique that you can use for time management, right? You need at least 13 hours of study time per week outside of class. Maybe a little bit more because this class is shorter. The lecture is a little bit shorter compared to other 241 lectures because it's hybrid. All right, so you got to find that time someplace. And anybody who's passed this class has found that time, right, including me. And just write down what you think, where you can study during the week, maybe on a Monday or Sunday. Put down how many hours or when you're going to study, and then as you accomplish that, write down below it, fill in the time that you spent on that particular day and time. And then after that week has gone by, compare the two to see how well you're doing. And you might need to rearrange your schedule to get the amount of correct study time in. All right, so here's that syllabus. What do we do? I want a copy of the syllabus, but I don't want to go to the web every time. Right-click, save link as. Sure, I like that title. Okay, I'm going to save it. Now that's a PDF file. All right, so I'll be able to get that anytime I want. And welcome letter basically tells you how to log into Blackboard. Some people that are going to register today, all right, they'll get all these things in hard copy. And of course, you need the welcome letter to know how to log into Blackboard. Everybody that's logged into Blackboard doesn't need that anymore. We've got some good plugins here. If you need a Windows Media Player to listen to recordings, DVX Video Player, that's a really powerful media player. And of course, it's free. It doesn't load up a bunch of junk on your computer. And a PowerPoint Viewer. These are free if you want to look at your PowerPoints after you download them. But it doesn't give you editing capabilities. It only gives you viewing and printing capabilities. All right, so that's something. That's pretty much a quick overview of some of the things you can find in Blackboard. Ah, one other thing for this class. Nice. Go to Tools. And in Tools, you're going to see your grade book. All right, so this is where I'm going to put your grades. And when you take an online quiz, your grade is going to be there before you have time to look. So as soon as you hit submit, boom, that grade is in there. When you take a lab grade, your lab instructor has to send me the grades, and so it's going to take a while for that to happen. Maybe every 5 weeks or so, 3 weeks, I'll get an update. One of the lab instructors has access to Blackboard, and he'll just do that automatically, so I won't have to pay attention to that. All right, so you can keep track of your grade. Also over here, McGraw-Hill, this is not the link. The link is over here. If you bought a new textbook, it came with an access code. And that access code will give you access to the e-version of the textbook. So you can look at the electronic version of the textbook. And if you bought a used book and you'd really like to try that out, you can buy an access when you go into here as well, give them a credit card or something. I don't know how much that costs. Right? But when you buy a new textbook, that's all included in there. Study guide, access to the ebook, and a hard copy of it. Okay. So those are the important things in Tools for you to look at. All right. So what do we want to do today? We want to do something like Chapter 1, okay, Study of Body Function. So I'm going to get into this lecture Not quite sure if we can finish it today. All right, but before we start, I want to make sure that I answer anybody's questions. Anybody have any questions about how you get oriented with Blackboard and the important part of the class? Hello. Yes. Nothing else. I have all the other practice quizzes in Blackboard. And what that access code gives you access to is something called Connect. That's the McGraw-Hill product. And the e-textbook is part of Connect. And I don't use Connect for testing or anything like that. Some other classes I do. Okay, and I'm not sure if that's helpful. I'm still working out some details with other classes. I use Connect and Learn Smart as well. And stop by, talk to me about those products if you have used them in a class, either Connect or Learn Smart, and maybe you could give me some feedback. And guess what? You think we're going to talk about feedback today? Yes, right? If you did a pre-lecture reading assignment, I'm sure I have mentioned in there feedback. Okay, let me turn some of these lights down so that you can view the slides a little bit better. That's good, that's good. Too dark? No? Let's try this. Let's try this at least today for a little bit of today. And then later on I can turn more lights on if it's too dark for some people right there. All right, so we go to 12:45. These are strange times, but that's okay. I have my syllabus right here. All right, so this is physiology. This class comes after anatomy, right? It's in a sequence of classes. And anatomy is fundamental to physiology. You should really know anatomy before you know how the body functions. Like if you're going to learn something about a microscope, would you like to know how it should you? Should I give you a description on how to use it, or should we work on the anatomy of a microscope first? Should you know the pieces of a microscope or how it functions? Yeah, if I tell you we'll use the fine focus knob and the iris diaphragm such and such and such a way, it's a perfectly good instruction, but if you don't know the anatomy of a microscope, then it's not really good. It's not going to help you very much, right? Same thing for a car. If you don't know what a brake pedal is or a steering wheel, I could tell you all day long, right, and it just won't make sense. So all of you guys are through anatomy, and I didn't mention this before, but that's the prerequisite for this class, right? If you want an ad code, you're going to have to show me that you did pass either 231 or 210 with at least a C, because anatomy is a prerequisite. So anatomy is the study of the structure of something. Could be a structure of a molecule, could be a structure of the heart, could be structure of your hand, structure of a muscle, right? And that structure then will help you understand what the function is, okay? And the structure then determines pretty much what the function is. The function really doesn't determine the structure, but structure does determine what the function is. And physiology then is the study of function of the human body, or the function of any kind of living system, but we're going to focus on the human body in here. All right, so y'all know that here's a hand, right? And how many digits do I have on this hand and also this hand? Yeah, I got 5. I'm really proud of that because I grew up in a machine shop, my uncle's machine factory, punch presses and stuff like that, and I still have all of my digits. That's wonderful, okay? Well, this hand is kind of amazing because it has a thumb, right? It's got a special joint. You can move your thumb anterior to the palm of your hand and use it for grasping something, right? So I can grasp tools really nice with this hand, right? So the structure of my hand allows me to do that, allows that particular function. But if by accident I lost a thumb, right, would the structure of my hand change if I lost the thumb somehow? Sure, the structure. I only have 4 digits now instead of 5. What about the function of my hand? Definitely changed as well, right? Much more difficult to grasp things because you don't have that opposable digit. Okay, so that is there's always a link between structure and function. Structure determines what the function is, right? Not the reverse way around. But if you ever notice a change in function, right, maybe from normal to a pathological condition, you can infer something, right? What is it that you can infer? If you see a change in function, that also means something else has changed. The structure of something has changed, and it might be the structure of the plasma membrane, structure of the heart, or maybe even the structure of a molecule will change how your body functions. All right, so we're going to look at that. So physiology is the study of normal function. Pathophysiology is the study of how things go awry, what kind of disease states are produced by changes in physiology, right? Which usually means that there's a change in structure someplace. You have to look for that. Okay, let's look at this for just a second. Another little orientation right here, and it has to do with scientific method. Don't know if you guys have taken a science class, like a biology class. I really recommend that you do, because we don't talk much about biology in here. Scientific method is really important. I want you to know why it's important for a couple reasons. All right, so here are some tests or some steps for the scientific method. First, you walk around the world and you see a pattern repeated over and over and over again. And you say, oh, well, when this happens, something follows from that. There's a cause and effect. All right, like when you come to physiology class and listen to me, you learn stuff. At least I hope you do, right? Hopefully my lectures are good enough. So you then come up with a hypothesis, a guess, whether or not that repeated pattern is actually true or if it's maybe just a coincidence that something happened, right? Maybe you talk to a friend in the hallway and learn something and it looks like I taught you something. That may or may not be true. All right, so then you come up with a hypothesis. Oh, sorry, I forgot to do something here. It's really annoying if I don't get this worked out. My arrow went away. Let me get my arrow back all the time. Okay. Okay, so after you see some repeated pattern in your world, you come up with an explanation for it, and that's a hypothesis. It's a kind of a complicated word to talk about, and it's a guess on how the world works, how the natural world works. So a good synonym for hypothesis is guess, right? All right, and then once you have that guess, you write it down on a piece of paper and figure out if you can come up with some kind of test to see if that guess is correct or incorrect. And so we conduct experiments to do that. We analyze the experiments to see if your observations really are true or not. So is your guess really important? Is it working? And after you get that scientific experiment done, okay, you can draw conclusions whether or not the results support the hypothesis. So what does the experiment do? It figures out how good your guess was about the natural world. Okay? And if it is a good guess, if your scientific results support your hypothesis or your guess, right, some other people are probably interested to check and see what your results are like. And if you can repeat those experiments and get the same results, and if other people around the world can repeat that experiment and get the same results, then it can become a theory. Right? So we use that term in our normal everyday vernacular, probably very inappropriately. Right? So a theory, which one is more correct, hypothesis or a theory? A theory is much more reliable, and that is really the reason why we go through all of this rigmarole, and that is because we want reliable information, right? So the scientific method, the reason why there's a scientific method is because it gives us reliable information. That's really the take-home message, the first take-home message. Okay, so remember, hypothesis is guess, and theory is something that has support from scientific experiments. And usually when we're walking down the sidewalk, talking with friends, and you come up with a pretty bright idea of how an explanation of how the natural world works, what is it that you usually say? Do you ever say, I have a hypothesis about something? No, you usually say, I have a theory, right? And that's okay in everyday language, but in science, that would be a gross misuse of that word, because a theory has a lot of important meaning behind it, right? But it's just too tough to say hypothesis all the time when you're with your friends. That's okay. All right, so a theory is something that you can rely on. It's a general statement explaining some natural phenomena, and it's based on a proven hypothesis. That's important. Okay, in this textbook, here's the second most important point, or another important point, okay, is that you're going to be reading a lot in your textbook and coming upon some really strange information that is going to go against your inclination or what your impression is, okay, and it's not going to be very intuitive. But all the information in your textbook okay, is one or the other of these things. It's either a hypothesis or a theory. And guess what it is in your textbook? It's a theory, right? So no matter how strange something sounds when you read it or I tell you in class, if it's in your textbook, it's at the level of theory. It's something that you can rely on. So that's really important, right? There's really no guesswork in this textbook right here, right? And if we talk about guesses or hypotheses in class, and I do, right, because not everything is in a textbook, I'll tell you, it's not a theory. It's just a guess that I have. And you have to pay attention to that, and you might see in your career that it does work out to be that way, or maybe it won't work out that way. Okay? But I'll be sure to tell you when something is hypothesis and not theory. All right, so what's the take-home message for scientific method? What does it provide for us? Why is it a good thing? Even though it's a real pain to go through all these different steps, why is it important? So that should just kind of rolling right off the tip of your tongue. What does it provide? Reliable information. Yeah, that's a really important couple of keywords, reliable information. All right, a couple other things about testing a hypothesis. We want to have usually two groups because sometimes we're not sure what the effect of a particular intervention is. So we want to have an experimental group and a control group, two groups of people, okay? And the experimental group, let's think of maybe some kind of pharmaceutical experiment. And let's just say we want to see what the effects of synthetic estrogen is, right, on somebody's body. So estrogen is an oily compound, and you have to inject it, and it doesn't dissolve in water. So when you take estrogen, guess what you have to dissolve it in before you can give a shot to somebody? It has to be dissolved in oil, right? So your shot is oily as a result of that. So when you have a control group right here, then all of these people have to get a shot as well with a syringe because maybe just giving somebody a shot will affect their physiology, right? Because our mind is connected to everything. So they have to get a shot. But what else do they have to get? They have to get that oil as well, right? They have to get the oil, but not the estrogen because oil even has estrogenic properties all by itself. So when we compare these groups, then we're controlling for the effect of that oil that has entered somebody's body. So that's what we mean by experimental and control group. And of course, the person that's giving the shot, right, should know which is which. They shouldn't even know why they're giving somebody a shot because their demeanor might influence how a person reacts. And you've probably heard stories of a physician or a group of physicians outside somebody's hospital room talking about another patient, and they say, oh, this patient is in really bad shape. They're not going to make it. I'd be really surprised if they make it through the day. They could die in the next 10 minutes. And the patient in that room is hearing these physicians talk, and they're thinking that they're talking about him. Guess what can happen to him? Yeah, he could just kind of make sure that that statement is true, right? They could just kind of give up. All right, so the person that is doing the experiments shouldn't really know what the expected results are or really what they're doing. We call that a blind study, right? They should know how to do it professionally, but they shouldn't really know what the expected results are. All right, and then after the experiments are performed, right? Oh, here it says right here, blindly. There is the best experiments are experiments that give you something in an analytic form, something you can measure. All right, not just an impression of something. Impressions are very important, but sometimes it's really good to be able to measure something with a ruler, for instance. We call that quantitative measurement. So could you think of maybe another thing that you could measure quantitatively in somebody, just besides maybe their height or their width? What else could we measure in somebody quantitatively? Weight. Oh, yeah, we could use a scale. Absolutely. Weight is a really good measure. All right, and how about one more thing? Pressure. Sure, that's something we can measure, right, on somebody's arm like that. And there are many other things like pH and temperature with a thermometer, right? So those are nice quantitative measures. And then we get those numbers, and the reason why we'd like to get those numbers is that we can then analyze those numbers. We call that data using statistics. Right? And the good reason we want to use statistics is because it's impartial. It doesn't have a feeling which way things should go, one way or the other. right? So it's important to use statistics because it's unbiased. It's an unbiased method of analysis. And it can tell us important things about the results from this experiment and whether those results support or don't support the hypothesis to have that thought become a theory. All right, so here is the first important thing about scientific method. What's the purpose? Purpose of scientific method? Why are you happy everybody does it, even though you have to pay for it? It gives you reliable information, some information you can count on. And what about in your book? Are you going to read a bunch of hypotheses or theories? Theories, yeah, something that you can count on. And if it's just a guess on my part, I'll tell you. All right, so that's pretty much all I want to talk about scientific method, because you're going to be reaping the benefits of that when you read your textbook. That's going to be important. All right, here is an important concept. You'll be thinking of this probably every day in this class. So it's a key concept. It's a cornerstone concept, and it is homeostasis. But it's maybe the first time you think about it, it's a little nebulous, right, to get your hands around. All right, so I'll give you some examples. Homeostasis is a condition in which some kind of parameter, we talked about some parameters like pH, temperature, somebody said blood pressure, wonderful, right? Some fluids, maybe glucose concentration, right? So there are a lot of factors in the internal environment, which means what? Inside you are maintained within a range of values suitable to support life. And I think you're kind of familiar with that. If you were to measure your temperature day in and day out, what could you tell me about your temperature? It varies a little bit, okay? But does it, the temperature in this room here is maybe 70 degrees, does it ever go down to 70? No, because that wouldn't support life, right? So so what this means is that your temperature can vary a little bit, but it has to stay within a normal range in order to support your life. So homeostasis means how things stay the same by changing a little bit, which is kind of a strange concept. So it's really a dynamic state. It's not a constant state. It's a dynamic state where all the body systems are working together, constantly adjusting to the changing internal environment and also the external environment. When you go into a cold building, your temperature doesn't change. You go into a hot building, your temperature doesn't change. All right, so I like to think of homeostasis as a dance of all of these different parameters. They're changing all the time. They're influencing each other, but nothing is changing drastically because that would produce a disease state. And I got to get a Star Trek episode. Who is the doctor in Star Trek? The original one. Uh-oh. Okay, that goes maybe way too far back for most people. Well, who was it? It was Dr. McCoy, right? Bones. And he'd have a patient, put him in sick bay, and there would be a really fancy monitor on the patient, and they had a display, right? And it had little arrows. Maybe one of the arrows was for pH. Maybe another arrow was for pressure, temperature. Maybe concentration of oxygen in the patient's blood. So they had little arrows, okay? But now, what were the arrows doing all the time? They're moving up and down all the time. They weren't steady, okay? And so consider that a little dance of all these parameters, right, to maintain homeostasis in that particular patient. Now, what could you tell me if all of the arrows stopped dancing around each other? What would happen? Yeah, then a person's dead, right? You need to see that dance. And that's really the purpose of medicine, is to bring balance back to somebody's body so that parameters can influence each other and maintain homeostasis. Okay, so I need to talk about this some more. And actually, we're going to spend the whole class on this particular topic. So homeostasis is maintained by one thing that we call reflexes. And reflexes, we're going to learn a nice flow diagram for a response loop in just a little bit, but I want to look at some molecules that can be used to coordinate your body. Some of these things are what we call hormones. So a hormone is a signal. It's a molecule, but it's also a signaling molecule or a signaling compound. Sometimes I say signaling compound. A hormone is synthesized by a particular cell, and it's secreted outside the cell this particular gland, or this particular cell right here, is a gland. And I think from anatomy, you learn two basic kinds of glands. Anybody remember two kinds of glands? And this is going to be one or the other. Yeah, exocrine is one kind. What's another kind? Endocrine gland. Okay, so which one is this? Well, I see a blood vessel right here. All right. So this product from this cell diffuses from the cell into the blood, and then when it's in the blood, where does it go? Everywhere in your body where blood goes, right? So the distribution method for a hormone is the cardiovascular system, right? But that kind of gland is what we call an endocrine gland. Exocrine, what somebody mentioned before, that gland produces a product, secretes it, but it doesn't go into the blood. It goes into a duct, and that duct carries it. Like saliva is produced by a gland. Okay, not an endocrine gland, but an exocrine gland. Saliva goes then into a duct, ends up in your mouth. All right, so that's a nice characterization. An endocrine gland is a ductless gland because it's using the vascular system as its particular duct to distribute that product. All right, another kind of product, another chemical that's used for controlling and communication is a neurotransmitter. And when you see neuro right here, that's pretty much the key. Neuro means coming from, brain, spinal cord, right? And in there you have neurons, right? So a neurotransmitter comes from a neuron. Here you see a nice nerve cell. Looks like a nice multipolar nerve cell. You should refresh your memory of what these different types of cells look like because they have different shapes. Ooh, dang, what does that mean? If they have different shapes, they got different functions as well, okay? Okay, so this particular cell is secreting a neurotransmitter, and it's not going to go into the blood, just going to diffuse to a neighboring cell, and it's going to change the behavior of that neighboring cell when the neurotransmitter binds to it. Oh, that's a step I forgot over here. All right, the hormone goes into the blood, and what kind of blood vessel can this, or does this hormone have to have in order to get into this vessel? There are three main kinds of vessels. What are the three main kinds of vessels? You got a vessel that takes blood away from the heart, that's an artery. You got a vessel that brings blood back to the heart, that's a vein. And what's the third kind? A capillary. And from anatomy, you remember that a capillary is very thin, and that's the only kind of vessel where things can enter or leave a blood vessel. So this hormone enters the blood via a capillary bed, gets trapped in this circulatory system until it runs into another capillary, and it can diffuse out. And this tissue right here, or this cell right here, can become special. It can become a target tissue if it has something, right? It can respond to this hormone, and it's got to have something that we call a receptor, right? And so the hormone diffuses out of another capillary, bumps into the cell right here, and if there's a receptor, it will bind to that receptor. It's going to change the physiology of this cell. And you can probably guess already what's the relationship. What's the best way to think of the relationship between the signaling compound and the receptor? It has to do with structure, right? So your hand will fit into a glove if the glove is the right shape, right? Your key will fit into a lock if the lock and key match up to shape. This hormone will signal this target cell if the target cell has a receptor with the proper shape. And when you change that shape, then this target cell becomes completely blind to the effect of this hormone. Okay, so it's by shape. All right, same thing for this neurotransmitter. It just diffuses to another neuron or some kind of other cell. You can think of it as a target cell. And the reason why this neurotransmitter can affect the cell over here is because it has a receptor, right? And a receptor, we're going to see different kinds of receptors, where their location is by their physical chemistry. But the shape of that receptor has to match up to the shape of this neurotransmitter. And if you change the shape of the neurotransmitter, guess what happens? It might bind to the receptor, but it might not signal the receptor properly, right? Or maybe it can't even fit into the receptor anymore. Like I could ask to see one of the keys for your car, and then I could file it down a little bit, and guess what? It's not going to function, right? It's not going to work on your particular lock. All right, so here is another case. Here we have a nerve cell, and it's going to release a signaling compound, and that signaling compound is going to go into this blood vessel, and the blood is going to distribute it throughout the whole body, and it will diffuse out, right, and bind to a receptor on this cell and change the physiology of this cell. And when that happens, what could we call this cell right here? if it has a receptor that can bind the signaling compound and it changes the physiology of the cell. What kind of cell is this then? And by definition then, this is a target cell or target tissue. It has to have a receptor for some signaling compound. So these are what we consider long-range reflexes in the body. These are produced by hormones or neurotransmitters. They usually have a long life. They last for a long period of time, and maybe they're slow to have an effect. All right, so their onset of action is delayed, but their duration of action is very long. And you're going to see that to be kind of a common principle. I don't know why we don't call it some kind of, or understand that to be some kind of physical principle that all systems have to adhere to, but I don't even know of any examples that are contrary to that. So if there is something that can operate very fast, the duration is short. If there's something that takes a long time to develop, its duration is long. Like there are barbiturates, right? They have are very fast acting, but their effect on a person's body is just a very short period of time. There are longer lasting barbiturates, and it takes a while for it to affect a person's body, but what about the duration? It will last for a longer period of time. We can come up with all kinds of examples. All right, so what kind of signaling compound did we say a nerve cell secretes? A neurotransmitter. Okay, now what kind of signaling compound goes into the blood for distribution? A hormone. Well, look at this case over here. We're combining both of these first two cases. We have a neuron secreting a signaling compound, but it goes into the blood. What the heck are we going to call that? It doesn't obey the rules that we established over here. Right? And in this particular case, we're going to call that a neurohormone. So the nervous system and the endocrine system do work together in a certain couple places in your body. We're going to take a look at those. Okay, and as a matter of fact, in a lot of classes, we don't just look at the endocrine system isolated by itself and then the nervous system isolated by itself, because that's not how it exists in our body in all cases. You study both systems together and it becomes what? The neuroendocrine system. So that's going to be really fun to look at when we get to that point. All right, so the nervous system usually can control things in your body very quickly. Okay, travel long distances very quickly, but the duration of action is short. So you need something that can have a longer effect on your body, and that's what the endocrine system is for. Sort of like a nervous system, but what? It takes a little longer for it to develop an effect, and that effect will last a longer period of time. All right, so I want to talk about long-term reflexes and short-term reflexes, like for blood pressure. That's going to be really important. Okay. So in this case over here, why do we call this a neurohormone? In particular, why hormone right here? Why do we say hormone for this particular signaling compound? You can see it on the slide. Because how does that molecule get distributed? Yeah, by the blood. And that's not so for a neurotransmitter, right? The neuro part of this signaling compound comes from the fact that it's being secreted by a neuron and not an endocrine gland. But then you might be thinking, oh, well, this neuron right here really is an endocrine gland. Why? Because it's secreting a product, gets distributed by the blood, binds to receptor on a cell, and produces a specific response in this cell. All right, so sometimes the lines are blurred just a little bit, and we got to be familiar with that. Okay, what about shorter controlled mechanisms? Here we have a cell again, another cell over here. It produces a product, a molecule, and it secretes it from the cell, and it wants to signal something in another cell, another nearby cell, maybe one right next to it. So that agent is going to bind to a receptor on or in this cell, and it's going to change the physiology of the cell. If it is very short distance, we call that a paracrine agent, paracrine. All right, so a neurotransmitter could be thought of as a paracrine agent as well, because neurotransmitters usually just travel a very short distance. All right. Here is something pretty strange. Here's a cell will secrete a product that it synthesizes into the interstitial space, and it's going to bump into the cell membrane of the exact same cell that secreted it, and it's going to bind to a receptor, and it's going to change the physiology of the cell that secreted it. Right? And so we call that an autocrine agent. If a cell is actually controlling its own physiology by secreting something into the extracellular space. Right? So that's just one way maybe this cell right here could, maybe this autocrine agent is going someplace else and telling some other target tissue to change its physiology, but this cell really wants to know how much of that agent it has secreted, right? So the receptors on this cell right here are measuring how much of the autocrine agent it is secreting and if it's the right amount or not. If it's too much, then it will stop secreting. If it's not enough, it will start secreting more so that the target tissue can respond properly. All right, so there's some mechanisms. Some more mechanisms. On this particular slide, okay, we have a measure on a graph or slide, particularly a graph. You want to know what you're looking at, the axes of a particular graph. So the horizontal axis right here is time, okay, and what's the vertical axis? What are we looking at right here? You know what? It doesn't say. You could make up anything. So let's make up something. We could think of glucose concentration in the blood, or blood pressure, or temperature. And it's really easy to think of temperature. So let's just say this is a plot of temperature versus time. Okay. And if we measure your temperature, it's going to go up and it's going to go down. Okay. And these dotted lines right here represent the range of what your temperature can be before you're in a disease state. If you get too hot, that's hyperthermia, that's dangerous. If you get too cold, that's hypothermia, that's dangerous as well, right? Both can be fatal. And this is the normal range. But we should know at this point in time what the exact average value is, right? So at any particular time, there's a pretty good chance you're going to be right at this average value. Anybody know what the average temperature is? And somebody? Yeah, 98.6 is what I recall. That's probably pretty good, right? But it can go up and down just a little bit. That average number is something that we call the set point. That's the number that your body is going to be looking at. And if your temperature is right at the set point, then your body is really happy. It doesn't need to make any changes because you're at the perfect temperature. Right? But let's just say your temperature starts to increase, right, away from set point, it increases away from set point, away from that ideal number, your body will measure that and say, hey, your temperature is getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. It's got to first be able to measure that parameter, and it's got to compare it to the set point to know if it's the same or different. Right? It's got to know what the set point is, and then it has to make a decision on what to do. And it sends that decision out through maybe secreting hormones or sending electrical impulses through neurons to target tissues to do what? To bring the temperature back down to the set point. So as your body gets hotter and hotter and hotter, what's the response that your body is going to produce? Yeah, you're going to start sweating, right? And that fluid is going to evaporate from your body, and that takes a lot of heat away from your body when it evaporates. Okay, so now your body's cooling. And it's cooling, and it actually gets colder than the set point. What is your body going to do then? It says, you're getting colder than the set point and approaching a pathophysiologic state. What is your body going to do? What's the decision that's going to be made? Yeah, you can start shivering, certainly close down those sweat glands so you don't lose that water. Okay, and then what happens? Your temperature starts to increase, right? And so it fluctuates all day long. So when you walk into a cold building, your temperature will decrease. Walk into a desert, really hot condition, your body temperature will increase, right? But it will never exceed, right, this normal range. So this bracket right here probably should go all the way to this dotted line. That would make sense to me. That would be the normal range. If your temperature is in this normal range, it is normal. If it is too high or too low outside of this range, then that's a pathologic condition. That's a disease state. Okay. So how does this mechanism operate? How does this line always get forced back to the set point? If it's too high, back down. If it's too low, back up to the set point. All right. It's done by what we call negative feedback loops. And that seems a little funny right at the moment because negative has what kind of connotation to it? Like, you want to be around negative people all the time? No. Kind of has a bad connotation, right? Positive has a good connotation. Not in the sense of control theory. Okay, homeostasis is maintained by what we call negative feedback loop. So when I see this parameter going up and down, I can see that homeostasis is being maintained because the temperature never goes beyond the normal limits. So a negative feedback loop is something that's really good to maintain. Let me go back to this. If there's positive feedback, guess what happens? Right? If your body's temperature starts to increase and there's a positive feedback mechanism starting to operate, what happens to your body temperature then? And you wouldn't know this unless you took this class. Then your temperature, so I'm going to tell you, even though a lot of people gave me a really good idea, okay? If there's positive feedback and your temperature starts to increase, then your body does something to increase the temperature more. And as your temperature increases, your body responds by producing more heat, and your temperature increases, right? And it keeps increasing, increasing if it's positive feedback, and then you just blow up into a ball of flames, right? Okay. Well, that's sort of silly, but it's sort of true. In order to stop a positive feedback mechanism, something really drastic does have to change in somebody's body. There are very few naturally and normal occurring positive feedback loops, okay? And we're going to look at a couple throughout the whole class and maybe mention them at the end of this chapter. All right, so right now, we're just looking at normal physiology. We want to be really interested in normal physiology. So what kind of feedback loop do we want to study, positive or negative? Negative, even though it has a nasty connotation to it. Okay, so what are the things? We got to look at some anatomy first. All right, so in order for you to detect a stimulus, say light, what do you need? How about a fingertip? Belly button. Is that good? Are those good receptors? No, you need eyes, right? So in order for your body to appreciate some kind of stimulus or something in your environment or something inside your body, you need a receptor for it. So the first thing is a receptor, and on this slide it's called a sensor. So that sensor or receptor detects the value of some physiologic parameter, like you said, blood pressure, temperature, or whatever. Okay, and we're going to call that parameter X, and X could be temperature or anything like that. And we see this little up arrow right here. That is a stimulus. And so what is happening to this parameter right here? With the up arrow, we're going to say it's increasing, okay, just by convention. And in order for your body to know that this parameter is increasing, it has to have a sensor someplace. And you know a whole bunch about sensors, you know, hair cells in the ear and pH sensors in the brain, temperature sensors all over your body, including the brain. All right, so it's got to be sensitive to that change in energy, modality of energy. And then the sensor can't just hold on to that information. It's got to pass it on to the place that has the set point. The place that has the set point or the absolute normal value is what we call the integration center. All right, so the integration center might get information from a lot of different places in your body. All right, and it takes the reading from the sensor, compares it to the set point, and it knows what to do. It can also make a decision. If the set point is equal to what the sensor is measuring, right, like 98.6 is the set point, sensor is measuring 98.6, what's the decision the integration center has to make? Nothing, right, because everything is exactly the way it should be. But if the temperature changes, the integration center can tell because it has the set point, makes a decision, and it sends it back out of, and the integration center usually is in the central nervous system someplace, not in all cases, right? Sends that information out of the central nervous system, right? What do we call a pathway that's leaving the central nervous system? That is an efferent pathway, or another way you could say it is a motor pathway. So here is a motor neuron, and I forgot to mention this neuron right here. How does information get into the central nervous system? An afferent. Right, so here's an afferent nerve. They have different looks, different structures. Okay, and the motor neuron then signals this effector organ. And this effector organ, when we say effector, what is it going to produce? Any effector in your body is going to produce something. And it's not labeled on this slide. It's going to produce a response. So go ahead and label this slide because it's deficient in a couple things. This over here is the stimulus. Here we have an afferent pathway. Here's an efferent pathway, effector, and an effector always produces a response. And response is this down arrow. Okay? So if we combine this up arrow and down arrow, what do? They subtract from each other, right? Because one is going negative, one's positive. So that's why we call this a negative feedback loop. So if the response subtracts from the stimulus, that's negative feedback. That's where that negative word came from. Okay. If the response adds to the stimulus, what happens? You blow up in a ball of flames. That's positive feedback, right? If it adds, that's positive feedback. All right, so that's a little bit better labeling of this diagram right here. Here we have kind of the same illustration as before. We got parameter X, and we can see that, is it constant over time? Is parameter X constant over time? No, it's changing. That's a good thing, right? You don't want to have any parameters in your body constant. So here is parameter X increasing, and it reaches this value. Does it go on beyond the normal range? It does not. So that doesn't, it's not an indication of any kind of disease process. But the other thing you notice is that it then goes back down. It starts to decrease. It first increases and decreases because this effector is activated. It forces that system back down to set point, overshoots a little bit. But nonetheless, when it's in an extreme, it always goes back down to the set point. Or if it's down here, it goes back up to the set point. Okay. So I would ask you right here, is homeostasis being maintained in a person's body that's behaving like this? You say yes, because the parameter is changing, but not drastically. Yeah.
Why would you say that losing X is a bad thing?
Oh, if it's absolutely constant?
Isn't that what homeostasis is trying to do?
It can't, because your temperature is changing all the time. Okay, and if your temperature is not changing, that means maybe you're in a refrigerator someplace. Okay? Okay. So our temperature, just because of our life, what we do, it changes all the time. Same thing for water balance. Same thing for pH. Same thing for your blood pressure. If you stood up right now and maintained the blood pressure that you have right now, guess what would happen? Things would look really gray, and all of a sudden you wouldn't see anything anymore, and then your head would bounce off the table, then the chair, then the floor, right? So your blood pressure does have to change when we change body position or other kinds of things. Maybe before a test, your blood pressure is going to increase too. Okay. Okay. So if somebody is alive, then these parameters are going to change. And that is a very important thing because maybe, let's think about water balance, right? So we're a solution of chemicals. We have to have water in our body. So the concentration of water is very important. Okay, and you would like to maintain, as you suggest, a constant level of water in your body, right? I wouldn't want my water to change. I wouldn't want my water concentration to go up or down. I'd like to be right at the set point, not ever change, okay? Well, what happens when you get hot? What do you start to do? Oh, but you said you don't want your water concentration to change. Well, what are you doing? Well, you got to give away some water, right, to bring your temperature back down. All right, so now you're messing with your water concentration in your body. So what is that going to stimulate? That's a response for controlling thirst and what your kidneys are doing. Okay, so they're going to compensate for loss of water. Loss of water is compensating for increase in temperature. And these things just go around and around and around and dance around each other so that none of them have to change by a large amount. So they're always changing all the time. If they're not changing, then they're non-responsive to what's happening inside your body or the external environment, and that would be a dead state for me, okay? Okay. So think of the dance. All right, so you see homeostasis being maintained right here. Now, what kind of feedback loop do you see in this figure that's being utilized? Is it positive or negative? Just by really quick inspection, you would say negative because the response is, or that parameter is always going to the set point, rather up or down, right? It's not continuing to go up, 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 and up, like we would like to see in our bank accounts, right? It goes back down to a set point. Or if it's too low, it goes back up to a set point. So yeah, it's easy to see right away what kind of feedback is being employed. And homeostasis is being maintained. So here is a really important concept map that you should just have ingrained in your memory, and indeed it is an extra credit drawing in lab this week. So on a blank piece of paper, you have to draw something exactly like this. I sent it out in the welcome letter. This might be just a little bit different. I don't know. Probably really similar. And you have to know this list of the anatomy of what a response loop has to have. Okay, so here's the concept map. What does a response loop always start with? Stimulus. We got that right here. And the stimulus, okay, in order for you to perceive that stimulus, what do you need? A sensor or a receptor, right? You need a pH receptor if you want to respond to pH or acidity changes inside your body, or a temperature receptor if you want to respond to temperature. And then the receptor sends that information into the integration center via an afferent pathway, right? And maybe from anatomy, you know the names of some nerves like light stimulus. How does that get into the central nervous system? Tell me the name of that nerve. What cranial nerve is it? Cranial nerve, right? Eyes are up here, brain's up here, cranial nerve. Two, right? Because olfactory is number one. I had to think a second. All right, but so you know a bunch of nerves already. Afferent pathway. All right, gets into the integration center, and it will analyze that data, compare it to something, make a decision on what to do. What does the integration center have so that it can analyze and make a decision? It's got a set point, right? Should know what the absolute average value is, makes a decision, sends it out through an efferent pathway, motor pathway to an effector organ, which always produces a response. Now that response can add to or subtract from the stimulus. If it adds to the stimulus, what kind of feedback is that? Positive feedback. Does that maintain homeostasis? It does not. It forces that parameter farther away from set point. If it subtracts from the stimulus, right, that maintains homeostasis because that parameter goes back down or up to the set point. So just about everything we're going to look at in this class, you should layer on top of this diagram right here so that you understand where these receptors are, what's the afferent pathway, where's the integration center, what kinds of decisions can it make, and how that's going to affect your body. All right, so that's pretty important. So know something about that set point. So probably you've known this because you've looked at reflexes before, like the knee-jerk reflex, monosynaptic reflex in anatomy, and you kind of all. So now you kind of know a response loop always begins with a stimulus and it ends with a response, right? And it could either be positive or negative feedback depending on how the response correlates or corresponds to that initial stimulus. All right, so here's a little bit of a word slide. Well, that clock is not very useful. Okay, I got to remember that. Negative feedback. Okay, it's some kind of body mechanism by which any change from that ideal value is made, what, greater or smaller? The change from ideal. Smaller, okay, or is resisted so that it doesn't keep changing in the direction that it's going. Negative feedback leads to a compensated, healthy state, and it maintains homeostasis. Right, so homeostasis, remember, is that dance of everything going up and down. The response subtracts from the stimulus. That's why we call it negative feedback. Right, and it just drives the system back to the set point. Positive feedback is just the opposite of that. Some kind of body mechanism which any change from ideal produces a greater change in your body. Right, forces that parameter away from set point, produces a disease state. Right, or sometimes we call that a decompensated state. And the system then drifts away from homeostasis. And what do you need to stay alive? Homeostasis, right? You need homeostasis. You need all these things dancing around in the right way. So if the response adds to the stimulus, then that's positive feedback. Okay. Okay, a couple other things about feedback mechanisms, control systems, regulatory mechanisms. There's something called intrinsic control. There's something called extrinsic control. Intrinsic control is a property that is a result and operates just within the organ that is being controlled. So the organ has a receptor. The organ has a set point. The organ produces a response all by itself. So that's kind of special. It's nice when an organ can do that. Here's an example that we'll elaborate on when we get to the cardiovascular system, but it's really important. It's called the Frank-Starling Law of the Heart. Right, that's an intrinsic control mechanism. That means that the heart can regulate itself to a large degree. Right, and it regulates itself by the amount of blood that's being presented to it. Right, if you have a lot of blood returning to the heart, do you think it's a good idea for the heart to get weaker or stronger? It's given more work to do. The heart automatically compensates because of the molecular mechanisms, and we're going to look at that. It gets stronger, right? So as more blood gets back to the heart, it gets stronger so that it can pump that blood. So that's the good side. Now, what's the downside of this intrinsic mechanism? So that doesn't require hormones, doesn't require neurons or anything. The heart just knows how to do that. But what's the bad thing about the Frank Starling mechanism? As you take blood away from the heart, what happens to it? Okay, if you give more blood to the heart, it gets stronger. You take blood away, so the ventricles don't fill up so much, what happens to the contraction? It gets weaker. Okay, now when is that a really bad circumstance? When do you not want your heart to get weaker when there's less blood going to it? Can you think of a condition? Condition. Go ahead, think just a little bit. What's a condition where not as much blood is flowing back to the heart? Congestive heart. Yeah, because the blood is getting trapped in some other part of your body. What about hemorrhage? How about you get into really bad automobile accident, bicycle accident, lacerate an artery. And so instead of all that blood being in that vessel, it's kind of running out on the sidewalk. It's on the sidewalk, not going back to the heart. So what happens to the heart under those conditions? It gets weaker, right? So that's a very bad decompensated state. The heart can't maintain homeostasis. Your blood pressure has a tendency to drop and drop and drop. There are positive feedback mechanisms that are under play there. We're going to look at that in better example. All right, so on the way to the hospital, thank goodness there were some EMTs. They picked you up off the sidewalk. They can't do anything with the blood. It's already gone. But what can they do to help you on the way to the hospital to get your heart function back? They can't transfuse you because they're not a doctor. But what can they put in you? Yeah, they can put just saline, a salt solution, right? They can establish an IV and get some fluids back into your cardiovascular system, right? It's not blood, but what's the magic thing? As the fluid volume of your blood vessels increases, more of it goes back to the heart. And what happens to the heart? It gets stronger. It's like magic, right? We can bring somebody's heart back. All right, so that's called Frank Starling Law of the Heart. We're going to look in some more detail of that. Okay, and that's intrinsic control. Heart does that all by itself, but fortunately you even have some other mechanisms that control the heart. Anybody remember some other mechanisms that can control the heart rate? I know you do. It was a whole chapter in anatomy. It's called the autonomic nervous system, right? And so parasympathetic stimulation slows the heart down, sympathetic speeds it up. Okay, and that is when the heart is changing its rate of contraction, force of contraction due to stimulation from the autonomic nervous system. That's outside of the heart. That's what we call extrinsic control. So there are a lot of mechanisms that rely on the extrinsic control. And here is just one example right here. And this is your body temperature is controlled by shivering, okay? And it's controlled by the brain. A lot of different organs are involved with controlling temperature. When you get too hot, you start to sweat. So temperature is controlled in your body by a whole bunch of organs, right? Just not one particular organ. This sweat gland right here, right, isn't activated by itself. It needs information from a sensor in a remote location in your body. Same thing when you shiver. The muscle itself that is contracting and shivering doesn't know that you're getting cold. It's just getting information from your brain saying that you're cold, right? Which is extrinsic control. All right. Now, when I look at this, here's a pretty easy question. What type of feedback is operating in the above example? Negative feedback, because everything is going back to set point. Okay. Here's another example of extrinsic control. On this graph, we're going to look at glucose concentration in the blood in particular versus time. Okay, and we got milligrams per deciliter. That's pretty standard dimension for glucose concentration in the blood. And we measure that, and we see it's just under 100 at all of these times. These are in minutes, right? And so time is progressing in this direction. Okay, and that's just because right at this time right here, we're going to do something. And so we're going to say this is just zero time. This is where something is going to change. And what's happening is we're going to take some insulin and inject it into this person. And insulin is a passport that allows glucose to be taken up by cells. Glucose can't get into cells unless there is that insulin signal, at least most cells. All right. So if if there's no passport, glucose is trapped in the blood. It can't go anywhere. But if insulin is present, then muscle cells can take it up and use it as energy. So as glucose goes into the muscle cell, what happens to the concentration in the blood? Yeah, it goes down, right? Just kind of a zero sum. You take it out of the blood, put it into a muscle cell, that maintains the health of that muscle. Okay, so we injected insulin here. Cells in the body start to take it up. Blood glucose concentration starts to drop. But we know that you should have the glucose concentration maintained by homeostasis, right, for just to be in a normal range. And if we continue to measure glucose concentration in the blood, I see that it starts to increase here, right? By 120 minutes, and it's almost back to normal. So when you look at this curve right here, you could tell me a couple things. What kind of feedback mechanism is being used? Negative. It's really obvious, right, if you see that. And is homeostasis being maintained in this particular location, condition? Yes, it is. All right, so just by the shape of these curves, you should be able to come up with that diagnosis. Here are a couple. Here's four examples of positive feedback. In a normal situation, not a pathological state, but a normal state, we'll talk in a little bit more detail about these mechanisms, but you should at least have some kind of list in your mind, all right? It's rare because positive feedback mechanism, what? Enhances or amplifies the drift away from set point. And it's very unusual to consider that maintaining homeostasis. But for instance, whenever you lacerate a blood vessel, you don't want that fluid just to run out of your body. We want your blood to clot. And would you like to wait around for a week or two, or would you like to stop that blood loss right away? Right away. Positive feedback mechanisms are really great for doing that, okay? Because it will, the effect of stopping blood loss will enhance the effect of stopping blood loss, and you don't want any blood loss, right? So coagulation is forming a blood clot. That's positive feedback. In females, it's used to create this is a hormone, luteinizing hormone surge that causes ovulation. Males have luteinizing hormone, but it does not cause ovulation, obviously. Okay. All right, so we say this is a positive feedback because when luteinizing hormone is secreted, that causes more luteinizing hormone to be secreted, which causes more to be secreted, and causes more to be secreted. So how come the whole universe isn't just filled up with luteinizing hormone? Okay, because something drastic happens, right? We said something drastic happens, like somebody has to burst into flames. In this particular example, the drastic thing is ovulation. Okay, the ovaries spit out this ovum, okay? That's a drastic situation. Then that positive feedback mechanism is stopped, okay? Positive feedback between the uterus and oxytocin secretion occurring during labor or parturition, all right? So oxytocin is a powerful, smooth muscle stimulus, causes contraction of the uterus, and that's going to, what, increase the speed of childbirth or allow it to happen? And as the uterus starts to contract, it causes the release of more oxytocin, which causes more contraction, which causes the release of more oxytocin, more contraction. Okay, so how come our whole universe is not filled up with oxytocin? Or everybody's uterus is just completely contracted? Because what happens under those circumstances? Something drastic happens. What happens? Ah, baby's born. That positive feedback mechanism is stopped. Okay, something drastic has to happen. All right, action potential, that's an electrical phenomenon in neurons. Just remember that relies on positive feedback mechanisms. All right, that's it for today. The way you add this class is at the beginning of lab, and I'm going to visit you guys at the beginning of lab, take roll call, give away some ad codes. All right, so I'll see you later, or see you Thursday if you have a Thursday lab.